CJSF 90.1 FM, and you're tuning into our super summer programming. I'm Hallelujah.
And I'm Stella. And together, we'll be highlighting the queer community, environmental issues, and upcoming local events.
Stay tuned for interviews, discussion, and music from our collections.
Burnaby is located on the ancestral and stolen territories of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples, the lands that they have cared for since time immemorial. Today, I am with Erica, the co-executive director of Environmental Youth Alliance, an organization that continues the stewardship of our lands within the Vancouver area. So just to start off, could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about you?
Hello, thanks for having me. My name is Erica. I use she, her pronouns. On my mother's side, I'm Japanese, and my father's side, I'm mixed European. So here as a guest on these lands and calling in specifically today from the unceded stolen land of the Squamish Nation. As Stella mentioned, I am the co-executive director of Environmental Youth Alliance. I've been with the organization for 6.5 years. And yeah, deeply love the work that I do, and also spend a lot of time on the land in my free time as well, with my dog, with my friends, on my bike, etc. But yeah, I think we'll get into more of the work stuff soon, so I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, lovely. We definitely will. So just first question right off the bat for some context, what does the Environmental Youth Alliance do in and for the Vancouver
community? Yeah, so Environmental Youth Alliance, we are a small nonprofit that's based out of East Vancouver. We were founded in 1989 by a group of high school students in the Vancouver region. And since then, we have, always had forms of youth leadership and connection to environmental work. So as of late, EYA has been focusing our time on working specifically with youth on Vancouver's east side, doing land-based education and environmental job skill training for youth facing barriers specifically. So we're working with BIPOC youth, Two-Spirit, LGBTQIA plus youth, youth living with disability, or other barriers, systemic barriers on Vancouver's east side. So we do lots of education programs and stewardship, and do a lot of stewardship specifically in the Strathcona neighborhood, as well as other East Van green spaces, kind of showcasing to youth that we can improve and make impact on the spaces like right in our backyard, and nature is right here for us.
Yeah, and I love that you mentioned stewardship, because I wanted to ask, because I think a lot of people don't know what stewardship might comprise or consist of. So what is environmental stewardship, or at least how would you describe it in EYA?
Good question. And yeah, I think it is kind of like it can have a lot of nuance in it. So maybe like the closest connection for listeners would be to like restoration, like ecological restoration is maybe one of the umbrellas that stewardship falls under. It's maybe more of like a technical definition sometimes, but essentially stewardship as we define it has restoration practices in it. So that might be like the removing of invasive species, so like the physically like pulling of blackberry, ivy, other kind of common invasive species in our areas, and then replanting with native species and supporting the native plants to grow, and supporting biodiversity and the climate crisis in that way. I think to me, stewardship kind of expands beyond just like that, like act, like the technical doing, and holds a bit more of like a holistic meaning to it, of like learning about and learning from the land and connecting to the land and caring for it in a bit more of like a deep way. So really encouraging youth to like learn about the plant relatives and connect with them, and support them in many different ways, whether it's, you know, sharing that with a friend and sharing, you know, how to care for the land in those ways, or doing an arts-based project, or collecting medicines that are then like turned into plant medicines that we share with the downtown east side or other folks in the community. So I think it's a bit of like a blurry definition, but I think ultimately it's like how we can care for the land and tend to the land in a good way.
Yeah, I think that's great. It's so necessary to have these kinds of interactions with the land that are not just based on going to it for a specific purpose and then leaving and having it as like a separate space outside of our city. So I think that's really great. Can you explain a bit more why it is so critical to have these kinds of land stewardship programs for youth, and specifically for youth from equity denied communities?
Yeah, I mean, I think like the benefits or the importance is so reciprocal, in that, you know, what I just spoke to with the stewardship, like there are clear benefits for the land with the actions that we're doing and caring for the land. But I also, yeah, recognize that there are ample benefits for the youth as well, and for communities as well. I think kind of like what I mentioned before about ensuring that like nature doesn't feel out there, like nature does have so much importance and value. You know, there's so many like health benefits and emotional regulation and all of these different pieces that, you know, there's a lot of studies that show that nature is valuable, but sometimes the barriers to access just feel so great, and nature can sometimes be advertised to us as this like big out there thing, and you know, you need to have your whole camping gear, and you need to have access to a car, and you need to, you know, look a certain way, do it a certain way, all of these things. So there can just be so many barriers to entry. So yeah, the fact that, you know, all of our youth can like walk to our sites, or we provide bus tickets so that they can easily transit to the sites, and their neighborhoods that maybe they've, you know, walked past or, you know, are connected to, just feels so important and like valuable of like, it's, yeah, the Strathcona Gardens, if you haven't been there already, it's like such an oasis in the middle of like what can feel like really like a hectic, overstimulating neighborhood right on Produce Row there. So I think just having that feels so valuable. And then beyond that, you know, the youth are not only connecting to the land and reaping, you know, kind of like benefits and like mutual growth that way, but a lot of our programs are equally as weighted on the relationships with each other and connecting with other youth, connecting with mentors in our staff team who is also youth-led, and, you know, building community and building relationships, which is really vital in the current state of the world.
Yes, most definitely. I like that you mentioned how it can seem quite exclusive to access nature, especially if we're talking about these like backcountry places that are distant and gear costs a lot of money. But we do often neglect the community spaces that we already have, and it's great that you guys are doing work in that. I was wondering, how did the organization create this kind of safe community space for learning, advocacy, and care to take place?
Such a good question, and it's like it's a lifelong, right? Like UI has been around for over 35 years now, and we spend a lot of our energy on both like our internal operations and increasing like how anti-oppressive those practices can be, and then also really focusing on having like trauma-informed programs as well. So continued journey for sure, and I'm not sitting here to saying that like our programs are a safe space, because I think that can be I don't know if anybody could ever say that. I think, you know, we strive to make them more accessible, more safe, and that's the best that we can do, and being like transparent and open with the youth is really important. But in terms of, yeah, some of those like actions that we have done to create that, kind of like the decreasing barriers, like I mentioned, we'll give every youth bus tickets to get to and from the program. We also provide like snacks as soon as the youth come in, so that, you know, if they haven't had access to breakfast, they'll be able to like get some energy right away. And we also provide lunch on all of our programs. And then each youth, we value their time and what they bring to the program so much. So all of our programs, youth either get an honoraria if it's a volunteer program, or they'll get a paid wage if it's one of our employment training programs. So those are kind of like the, like I guess, like logistical barriers we try to decrease. And then a lot comes maybe more in like the nuanced ways in which our we hire a staff team that is youthful, that is BIPOC or facing other barriers, and is representative, and like the youth can see themselves in the leadership. I think that goes a long way. And also having like peer mentors on our programs as well. So there's more touch points of trusted folks that the youth can lean on. We also, aside from like workshop series that we do, all of our programs are cohort based. So the youth are with the same group of youth throughout a season, like the whole summer season or the whole fall season. And that really supports kind of like trust building, relationship building. And we cultivate that further in the programs through, you know, icebreaker games, making sure that youth are feeling comfy before we might dive into like a big topic or, you know, more trust-based activities. So yeah, that kind of like continuity can go a long way with the youth as well.
Mm-hmm. Your organization seems to be structured a little bit different than other organizations that may not be so involved with youth. And I was wondering how that structure, or like what that structure looks like when it's youth-led for youth, and yeah, what kind of opportunities there are for youth to get involved.
Yeah, so the programs that we run that I've been speaking about, so we have a field trip program that's for school age youth, so kindergartner through to grade 12, and they'll come with their classrooms and visit. Then we have kind of one of our like flagship programs is our nature stewards programs, which is for high school age youth, where they come like on the weekends or in summer holidays for that like one time a week type of program. And then for youth that are in that older age range, like 18 to 25, that's when we have more of our like youth employment programs, where there's maybe like internship style programs or different volunteer programs, etc. So throughout kind of like those youth stages, there's like multiple ways that youth can kind of move through this leadership continuum. From there, in terms of our staff team, we try to have like shared leadership where possible. So we've moved to like a co-executive director model a few years ago, with the hopes of like continuing to support more youth in leadership positions and having like more support for our team. And then we have a super awesome team of five managers and then coordinators and other support staff who are kind of the ones that are mostly working kind of like frontline with the youth. So just trying to have like these multiple levels of support and like policies and practices to support the staff is how we've kind of framed it to ensure that folks, yeah, are feeling supported. And then we're a nonprofit, so we have a board of directors as well. And we strive for at least half of our board of directors to identify as youth as well. And then we also have a youth advisory circle who I absolutely love working with them. It's like a group of 10 youth, and they'll meet with me each quarter and provide guidance and do some brainstorms and support EYA and continuing to have a youth voice like at kind of the front of the work that what we do. So yeah, I'm always so grateful for all of the ideas and feedback that they're able to provide as well. So yeah, there's kind of multiple ways that we have youth involved in like all parts of our organization up to the leadership roles. But it takes time and it takes intentionality to create all of these structures and roles in ways that are sustainable and supportive and interesting to youth. Because I know sometimes, you know, people will put like, oh, like a youth can sit on a board, but if it's not set up in a way that's like welcoming and, you know, structured in a way that that voice can be heard, it can sometimes create more harm than benefit.
How do you incorporate decolonial practices into EYA, if y'all do? I did read on your website that it seemed like that was an aim, and yeah, I was just curious about how that looks.
Yeah, I think it's something, once again, kind of similar to like the anti-oppressive practices. It's like a lifelong journey and, you know, continuing to try new things. I think there's parts of our work that are maybe more like inherently decolonial. Like I think the act of pulling out of an invasive species, you know, invasive species are almost always brought to different lands from colonial practices and systems. So I think that's such like a beautiful, really tangible thing to do, like to literally pull that thing out of the ground and like plant a native species and like learn about it, connect with it and support it. So I think that there's a lot that is inherently a decolonial practice. So then I think as an organization, kind of like building the scaffolding around that and, you know, ensuring that we're naming that and we're teaching the youth about these things and like why we're doing that, it feels like a really important piece of what we do. You know, I touched on the trauma-informed practices and like other anti-oppressive practices. So there are those pieces both like internally and on our programs that we're continuing to like workshop and continuing to try to show up for our youth in good ways. We gather plant medicines and we try to do so in ways in which we are honoring Indigenous ways of knowing and, you know, upholding Indigenous ways of knowing alongside, you know, maybe more like Western science practices and like braiding these together in all of our curricula. So when we're harvesting, we may be like leaning on some teachings that elders have shared with us around honorable harvest and trying to harvest in a good way. And then we are processing these medicines and sharing it back with the Indigenous communities surrounding us or organizations on the downtown east side and trying to continue to share out the gifts that we might have to offer to the communities around us. You know, there's other, I think just in like what voices we bring into programs, we're always ensuring that we include visits from Indigenous knowledge keepers or elders in our communities to come into each of our programs and share their teachings with our youth. And we are so grateful and lucky for some of those relationships that we hold in the community. And then not to bore with like operations and stuff, but there's little things as well of like providing like flexible stats to our youth or to our staff, because you know, our staff come from so many different cultures and our colonial statutory holidays don't align with what other folks are celebrating. So ensuring we're providing like flexibility on that and giving Indigenous Peoples Day as a paid day off and other forms of like flexibility with personal time off and things like that, and just trying to have a more decolonized approach to, you know, employees and how we show up in work and how that is, as much as we try not to, it is so interwoven with who we are as a whole person and individually as well.
Yeah, definitely. Would you say there are any difficulties in committing to decoloniality when a lot of like maybe the broader environmental movement or the government may not share similar values or operate on more colonial frameworks?
Yeah, that's a good question. And yeah, I mean, I think short answer would be yes. I think, you know, there are the systems that be, and, you know, I think there's certain things in being a nonprofit and, you know, society's active board of directors, and there's like different like forms of power that come into these spaces that we have an incredible board of directors. But, you know, there's continually kind of like poking at what is upheld in these systems and like what do we need to continue to uphold, like what do we need to, you know, like checks and balances of all of that, and what do we actually have some like flexibility to like do it in a way that feels really values aligned. So like all of this, I guess in a nutshell, just like takes a lot of time, and you need to have folks on board to like have these conversations and explore options that might not be the status quo or like the easiest way. So sometimes, you know, as a nonprofit too, like, and we're a small team and resources are slim, and having time to do that can definitely be a barrier sometimes. And then, yeah, you know, funding comes from federal sources sometimes, and there's employment standards that are set in certain ways. So it's always, yeah, we are not separate from these systems, but it is, yeah, how do we, you know, show up in these relationships and ensure we are, you know, following what we need to, and how do we, where do we have flexibility to continue to explore and have some conversations?
Yeah, definitely. Even at CJSF, there's always this balance, because we're also like independent nonprofit of like we need to maintain funding to be able to do what we want to do, but also retain our values and what we stand for. And I think a lot of nonprofits or independent organizations deal with that struggle.
Totally. Yeah, totally.
And are there any needs, do you think, that EYA addresses that the dominant environmentalist movement doesn't consider? Or even just, you know, like, people who think about environmentalism and they think of a specific type of environmentalism? And I was just wondering if there's any needs or, I guess, gaps that EYA can address?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you speak of like environmentalism, the form of environmentalism that EYA is, or I guess like kind of like our guiding principle would be the intersectional environmentalism. So kind of looking at both like social injustices and environmental crises, and like recognizing that the youth that EYA is working with are disproportionately impacted by these climate crises and also excluded from being a part of, you know, the discussion or environmental advocacy and careers. So there are systems that are kind of like from both angles oppressing the youth that EYA might be working with. So yeah, absolutely gaps in the sector. So I think especially when looking at our employability programs that are, you know, designed to support youth and kind of like launching into an environmental career. You know, these programs try to look at needs in many different ways. So yes, we're doing like the technical learning of, you know, restoration practices or native plant horticulture. But how do we also support youth in like unpacking what professionalism means and like what they might need to uphold in decolonial ways, or you know, communication styles and some of these like soft skills, and even the act of just like working on a team on the land together and what you might be able to take away from that. So trying to empower them and, you know, give them skills so that they can navigate careers in the environmental sector, and specifically, you know, a sector that isn't always built for everyone. So yeah, that's kind of our goal with a lot of those programs.
Nice. And I know you mentioned earlier that the work that you do is really meaningful to you. And I've noticed a pattern of a lot of people who work in nonprofits or independent organizations being really passionate about the work that they do. And I was wondering if you could just, if you wanted to share about like why it's meaningful or like what you draw from your work.
Yeah. Yeah, so I am a person of color, and I feel really lucky to have had an upbringing where I was really connected to nature, and I think that inspired my career path, and I know that that's a privilege that not everybody gets. And yeah, so anyways, fast forward through the career to getting into outdoor education. I was working at a few different places doing outdoor education. And after some time, I, you know, was just kind of looking at who was accessing these programs, and continually was starting to feel a little bit frustrated of seeing more affluent folks being kids and youth being able to access these programs. And I think knowing the impact that like nature access and connection had for me, you know, I was just like really, that gap was feeling really vital of like, I was feeling like people who needed these programs the most were not, like I wasn't seeing on these programs at all. So I was sitting in this, you know, frustration as I was like going through different workplaces. And yeah, then the EYA, a job opening came up. This was 6.5 years ago. And yeah, I think the fact that there's something there that's specifically tackling these, you know, kind of like two challenges or like focus areas of my life were kind of woven in together in this way that actually felt really like tangible and meaningful. Just like felt like I landed in the right place. And you know, now being at the organization for a few years and continually seeing the impact that, you know, being on the land side by side with people. And like, I feel so lucky when I get to go out and visit a program and be with youth on the land and just like get so much like joy and I think hope in a time that, you know, hope is really needed and can feel really far away sometimes. I think, you know, the small actions that we can do together in community on the land feel really grounding for me. So I feel really lucky to be able to do this work.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I do agree that it is really hard to keep seeing people from equity denied communities being even further denied just resources and funding and research, even when they're the ones who are the most impacted by things like the climate crisis. And so you guys are doing really important work at EYA. That's part of the reason I wanted to interview you and like put a little spotlight on your organization. So other organizations can maybe be inspired, or other people as well. And just a question, do you think there's anything environmentalist organizations and other movements could learn from EYA, or I guess the incorporation of Indigenous knowledge as well within EYA?
Good question. I appreciate the flowers as well, but I think like we're all in community together and we are continually inspired and in awe of some of the other incredible orgs and folks in our community as well. I think just, be intentional about engaging youth or incorporating a youth voice, but don't be afraid of it as well. I think sometimes, you know, when it's like incorporating Indigenous knowledge or incorporating youth voice, like you do want to do it well, and yes, do it well, but also don't lead with fear in that as well. And, you know, be open and transparent and intentional about it. And I think it can take you, really far. So yeah, no big words of wisdom, but maybe something along those lines. And happy to connect with other folks and organizations as well. We get a lot of joy out of collaborating with folks working in this space too.
Yeah, definitely. And just to begin wrapping up at least, I know EYA offers a lot of great programs. You've already kind of mentioned them, but it would be great if you could go over some of these in more detail for our listeners.
Yeah, for sure. So, if you are curious, our website is www.eya.ca, super straightforward, so you can find us there. So like I mentioned, we have our school field trip program. So if you're a teacher, specifically a teacher in East Vancouver or other under-resourced neighborhoods, definitely reach out for our Wild Mind field trip program and come and bring your classroom to a field trip at Strathcona. If you are a high school age student and interested in volunteering, our fall programs will open up fairly soon, and you can come out for like every Saturday in the fall or a different season in the future, and you can come learn about plants, engage in land stewardship, and help grow plants in our plant nursery. And you do get paid an honoraria, get bus tickets and lunches for that. If you are a youth that's 18 to 25, we have a few different youth employment programs. We have our peer mentor program, which is a volunteer program for youth that might be interested in exploring careers in environmental education. So in this program, you build skills and also shadow and support our younger youth programs as a peer mentor. So you're kind of there as a support and a building facilitation. Land-based facilitation skills there. We also have our Roots and Shoots program, which is a work experience style youth employment program where you'll come and do land-based training with our team for 8 weeks. So we'll have a fall cohort of that. And you will learn all kinds of environmental job skills as well as employability skills like building your resume, communication, etc. And that's a paid program. And we also have Cultivate, which is our workshop series program, a bit more lower barrier accessible for folks that want to build employability skills but might not be able to commit to a full-time program. And then finally, we have our Youth Habitat Crew program, which is our summer job opportunity program. And this is where a cohort of 8 youth come together and steward EYA sites throughout the summer. So lots of programs going on at different times of year, and we'd love to hear from you and see you on our programs.
Great. And how can our listeners who may not be able to volunteer or work at EYA, is there any ways that they can support?
Yeah, I think staying in touch, staying connected, find us on the socials, follow our newsletter, help share our work out with your communities. If you have connections to folks that might be interested in coming in as a guest or an Indigenous knowledge keeper whose voice you might want heard on our programs, feel free to reach out. We love to be connected with new folks. And also, we're a nonprofit and we need donations to survive. So if you want to donate, you can, yeah, just go to our website, uia.ca. There's a donate today number. And yeah, we appreciate any support there too.
Up next is an interview with DeFowers or the Golden Age of Wrestling, or Jeff. This song is Beyond Love and Beneath You off their album, Iconoclast.
Love, surround me now, pray for my soul. Away.
This is CGSF FM 90.1 Burnaby Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. We broadcast on the unceded ancestral territories of the Coquitlam, Musqueam, and Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Right now, today, I'm Howlin. I'm being joined here by Jeff, who you may know by a couple of different monikers. I have like a little boring bio that I can read out, or do you want to explain your infamy to the people on the radio?
CJSF, let me hear you scream!
Everybody's screaming beside the radio.
Thank you for having me. Hallelujah. Yeah, my name is Jeff. My stage names are Devours. And also I have a project called The Golden Age of Wrestling, and they despise each other. Yeah, so Devours is my main project. I've been playing shows in Vancouver for about 10 years. I kind of started as like a first wave, like hyperpop, like Canadian hyperpop artist. And I've released 5 albums. It's sort of morphed into like an electro punk, like dark wave project at this point. I sometimes play live with my friend Dave Prowse on drums. So we're usually a 2-piece now, but yeah. And then I have my separate project, The Golden Age of Wrestling, is like a wrestling alter ego villain who is very petty and aggressive and makes like ambient Hollywood soundtrack music.
Beautiful. I love it. And for those listening right now, The Golden Age of Wrestling is currently, as I'm recording this, number 2 on our CGSF chart. So you may have heard some of this music already in our regular rotation. Perfect. And besides all that pressy stuff, I just wanted to know, what's the latest song in your rotation, last song you listened to?
Oh my God. Okay. This band, I believe they're based out of Philadelphia. They're called At. It's just the At symbol on a keyboard. Mm-hmm. The song is called Auto Smile, and it's like a folk like masterpiece. It's like 7 minutes long. It is like unbelievably beautiful and like a masterwork of like modern folk. It's really, really clever and good. So yeah, check out the song Auto Smile by At, the At symbol.
Okay, I love that, because you know, like you're just talking about like at that with your Devours project being an earlier hyper pop adopter, you listen to folk. Is there kind of any other like kinds of music that you enjoy borrowing from or bringing into your various artist projects?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on like Slipknot. I'm wearing a Slipknot shirt right now. So yeah, I grew up listening to anything. Yeah, lots of guitar music, like angry teenager music, emo. I grew up listening to hip-hop, actually. I love hip-hop. Yeah, I'm kind of all over the place. I'm a huge fan of everything, honestly. I don't listen to a ton of classical or jazz, but yeah, even like some country and stuff. I think that all music is beautiful.
Oh, I love that. You played Jazz Fest, I think.
Shockingly,
recently?
Yeah,
yes.
I couldn't even believe, yeah, they invited me to play twice. I played it solo a few years ago, and then they brought me back just a month ago, and I played with Dave, and we played with Walgren. Do you know Walgren?
Yes, I know him, yeah.
Oh my God, Tegan. Yeah, so Tegan moved to Toronto about 6 months ago and is now finding greener pastures over in Ontario, which is, I'm happy for them and also a little bit jealous. But yeah, like their talent is insane, and it was a really fun show. The turnout was crazy, actually. It was really fun. So yeah, Jazz Fest, represent. Thank you for inviting me.
I love that. And to the listeners, before we get like, I get too into the meat of the show, I think me and you, whenever we've run into each other, we've talked on and off the record, our local scene politics and, you know, the struggle of being a person in the scene and making music. What do you think is like your biggest struggle in centering art in such an expensive city and in your own personal life?
That's an interesting question. Yeah. So I started out a little bit over 10 years ago now. So I've been like in the scene for quite a long time. I think my struggles early on were like making music in a genre that like people weren't really doing in Vancouver. And so that was really hard. I felt like I had to like prove myself to the punks and to like the guitar bands. Because I mean, Vancouver has always been kind of like a guitar city. Like it's a rock city. There's lots of punk, garage rock, metal, stuff like that. And so yeah, I mean, also at the time, there weren't really any, like, vocally gay artists in the scene. And so I was like, cool, I'm screwed. Like, from day one, I was like, there's no way I'm ever going to be heard or, like, find an actual, like, audience or, like, peers that are doing this. And so I think that those were the challenges more so than the cost of things, because Devourers is pretty, like, self-contained. I've always been DIY. I make music in my bedroom and mix it and master it. And so, yeah, that hasn't been quite as much of a challenge. But, yeah, I mean, Vancouver's insane. It's so, so expensive. I've been in, like, basically living in a dorm room for the last 10 years because I can't afford anything else. And I also have to, like, have, yeah, like, jobs on the side, you know, which is totally normal. Most people, you know, in their late 30s and stuff are, like, part-time lawyers and teachers. And those are, like, the most successful musicians in Vancouver. Like, almost no one can just be a musician here. And so, yeah, you need to really be a hustler in the city to survive. And you need to be adaptable because, yeah. Trends come and go, people come and go. It's very transient, it's very youth focused. It's like, it's a pretty difficult game to play.
Yeah, I also kind of like, I also agree on that statement. Something I always think about in terms of art is that, like, people will always find a way to make it work. If they are able to, like, you will take on the second job. And I mean, almost everybody I know in Vancouver has a second job at this point. Yeah. That's something else to say, but the cost of living. And on top of that, the garage kind of rock-centered thing has been interesting because, like, you know, we've lost so many spaces. And the spaces that I feel like we are losing in Vancouver in terms of arts and culture are mostly, like, queer spaces run by BIPOC. We lost Take Your Time Back a couple months ago now.
I love that place so much. I used to perform there all the time. I sing in a choir, like a big 40-person East Van choir called Esquire. And we used to rehearse in that space. It used to be called the Toast Collective. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I kind of, like, got my start, like, finding my voice in Vancouver. This was around 2014 or so, even before, like, Devourers had performed. Then it turned into 648 Kingsway and then Take Your Time. And so, yeah, that space in all of its iterations over the last, like, decade and a half or whatever has been, like, very magical and sentimental to me. And, yeah, you're right. Spaces are hard to come by. Vancouver venues open up and then they're gone for, you know, like, a year or two later. But, yeah, Vancouver scene is just, like, overflowing with talent and musicians. It's such a crowded, amazing music scene, and there aren't enough places to play. So, yeah, it's, like, a constant challenge here.
Yeah, and I'm on top of that, like, you'd also mentioned, like, this, like, youth-centered kind of culture. I will say I am 23, I am just turning 23, and I can say I'm already starting to feel a little washed up. I went to a local show.
Don't you dare say
that. For the listeners, I went to a show, and I, like, was having a conversation with some 18-year-olds, and they were talking about music, and I was like, oh, it must be over for me. They're like, don't worry, there's still time to turn your life around at 23. Oh,
my God.
I'm still kind of recovering from that little ego blow, honestly.
That is wild.
But you had, like, an Instagram post kind of talking about how sometimes there's this, like, sense of abandonment from the local scene or even at the larger, like, music industry in Canada. And it was kind of funny because I had a conversation with a musician that was, like, in their 40s and 50s about how these, like, larger infrastructural things, like, you know, something like the CBC is not supporting artists that maybe were really, really big in their 20s. And it's just always on to the next big shiny thing when these people aren't done producing good quality art. I just wanted to hear more of your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's opening a huge can of worms, but thank you for reading the post. Yeah, I mean, this is on my mind a lot. I'm 41. I'm not trying to hide it or embarrassed by it or anything. I'm very aware that the young people in the scene probably see me as, like, the gay uncle or, like, the dad of the scene or whatever, which is fine. I think that, yeah, it's a very superficial industry. You know what I mean? It's a very youth-driven industry. Young people are the people who are driving culture and who are going to shows. A lot of the people my age, like elder millennials and stuff, aren't even really performing that much or going to shows much now. They're, like, raising kids. And so for me, I mean, the music scene is very, very social, right? Like, people go to shows to hang out with their friends. Like, it's so social. Like, the whole scene is very social. And so it's a fascinating experience and kind of devastating when you kind of get into that, like, mid-30s onwards, where it's like, my friends aren't really going out much. They're, like, just watching Netflix and raising kids and stuff. And then, like, everyone else is half my age. And so it's like the societal pressure of, like, feeling awkward. It kind of feels like going to a high school party, like, 2 years too late. Mm. And it's like, Jeff, you're still passionate. You're still making cool music, but, like, maybe the moment has passed. And that's a constant battle inside of me of being like, no, I'm still invested. I'm still, like, 23 in my heart and in my spirit. But, yeah, I mean, the scene is ageist, and it's a little awkward being around younger people who are obviously, like, judging older people. But, yeah, I don't know. I think that I'm trying to sort of, like, blaze a trail and be like, you know what? My life isn't heteronormative. You know, I think that I'm actually maybe even getting better as a musician. I have more to say now. It's not like I'm washed up or boring as a 40-year-old. I'm, like, more political. I'm, like, maybe more interesting now than I was when I was younger. And so, yeah, people can take it or leave it. I'm not going to be able to please that many people out there, but I'm just still going to do my thing.
Yeah, good art is good art. That's kind of, like, I think what the crux of it is. You got your Polaris long list a little bit back with Homecoming Queen. Good record.
Oh, my God, thank you. Thanks for, like, reading up on me.
I have to. Yeah, that's part of my job. Yeah, I mean, like, and on top of that, like, people on the West Coast are just, like, not as included with recognitions like the Polaris. It was just you and Haley Blaze, I think, that were recognized on that long list from Vancouver, BC. But, like, very underrepresented, I think, looking through, like, you know, like, all those SOCAN awards or even something like the Junos or whatever. With something like the Polaris that's supposed to be less, like, about the numbers and more about the aspect of art, I think it just makes me a little sad that, like, there's a lot of great art being made here. Put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, I think Vancouver for the last decade has really struggled with its, like, industry infrastructure. Right. So even Polaris, which is meant to sort of be, like, for the, like, indie artists across Canada, it is still kind of an industry award. Like, almost everyone who gets nominated for it is, like, in the industry machine. They're on labels like Royal Mountain and like Secret City in Montreal and stuff like this. So they're already kind of supported. Yeah. It's not something that I wanted to, like, elaborate on too much when the Polaris thing happened, but it was totally crazy. I think I'm one of the only artists in history in Canada to have made something that was, like, literally DIY and self-released and to be nominated. Like, even Haley Blay is, like, supported by the industry machine at this point, and she's, like, on arts and crafts and stuff. But for me, it just sort of felt like a lifetime achievement award, maybe. I'm like, this is probably never going to happen again. I don't know if it's going to, like, maybe I got, like, 3 new Instagram followers from it. So it's not like Polaris led to this, like, huge explosion in my career or anything, but it just felt like, wow, like, acknowledgement for, like, an actual underground artist in Vancouver, which, like, never, ever happens. And, I think that something that I discovered a few months ago is that there's a new prize in Western Canada. They just launched it. It's called the Meridian Prize. And it's sort of like the Polaris of, like, Western Canada and Northern Canada, which is really neat. Yeah, I haven't been nominated or anything, but, like, the band Emma Goldman, who's, like, an awesome hardcore band in Vancouver, they got nominated for their album last year, which I honestly think should have been nominated for Polaris. It's, like, a very special album. It looks like some people in the Canadian industry are, like, trying to make some changes to represent Western Canada a bit better. But, yeah, I think the biggest surprise for people out east is that Vancouver is the third biggest music hub in Canada. Right, based off of population after Toronto and Montreal, like, Vancouver's huge. It is a huge music scene. There's overflowing with artists, but because there are so few labels here, then they're not necessarily recognized. And so it just feels like a wild, wild west of just, like, underground DIY culture that no one understands outside the city. So yeah, Vancouver is very, very misunderstood and very talented.
Yeah. I love the scrappy nature of it. Like, oh, you don't want to have venues. You want to let us, we'll figure it out. It's kind of the vibe that I've noticed, like being somebody who's only been really playing shows since after the pandemic. But yeah, I want to give a quick moment to, a moment of respect to the fallen music festivals of this city. Rifflandia, gone this year. I don't know if you heard about that.
Absolutely.
But I've been talking with a lot of folks at the station about things like Pemberton and Squamish Valley. There was that very short-lived hip-hop festival, Breakout Festival, which is too similarly named to Breakout West. So that made Googling a little bit. I learned about VEMF, which was one in Victoria, like Vancouver, or Victoria Electronic Music Festival. And it's just like a crazy kind of transition point where I guess like as grant funds get tighter and the economy is strange, like, you know, one of those first things that gets put to the chopping block are these important art festivals, some of them a little bit more corporate and mainstream than the other, but still like there's something to aspire for through those. But along that tangent, I would love to hear a little bit more about the show you're playing soon. Just plug it to our listeners.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, Vancouver needs festivals. This has been on my mind for years now. I think Music Place is going through a hard time as well, and they're trying to sort of like restructure and relaunch for next year. But then I really noticed the lack of like, yeah, Music Place this year. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, Green Auto Fest has like pulled up and is doing amazing things. But yeah, in terms of like a bigger thing, we had Westward Music Festival that was put on by MRD a year ago, maybe a year or two ago. I played that with Haley Play, actually, and that I don't think exists anymore. So yeah, it's hard. Like, Vancouver's expensive. It's hard getting people out here. But, yeah, the show that I have this upcoming Friday, I'm not organizing it, but the Wise Hall is organizing it, along with my friend Hank Pine, who is performing. And it is a non-corporate pride showcase, basically, with another band called Hyenas. They're also playing. And so, yeah, lots of, like, queer artists. There's a drag artist named Batty Banks who is going to do a few numbers, I think. And I'm going to headline that. So, yeah, it's going to be this upcoming Friday at the Wise Hall. Tickets are still available.
There's too many great, like, events going on kind of beforehand. I might hit the Normie Corp, but I will say I'm, like, a little bit, like, I'm at my inside era. I'm trying to chill a little bit, but you know, like, I think you're earlier on in the interview, you're talking about, like, you know, reaching an age where like your friends are like having kids and settling down and they don't want to go out to shows. Generational shift. Gen Z is like the least fun generation ever. I don't know if you've like heard about these numbers, like,
yeah,
Gen Z people go out the least amount and spend the least amount of money, have like the least like amount of experience with relationships, and I'm like, yeah, I don't love going out as often as I feel like I'm supposed to as a young person. And I also think that kind of does translate to some aspects of show going and ticketing. You know, most boring and unfun generation ever, but wearing that badge with pride.
Gen Z rules. I love every Gen Zer that I meet. I'm just like, you are awesome. So yeah, I'm very on board with Gen Z. Yeah, it's going to be a busy weekend. I played a corporate pride, like Vancouver Pride, like the big whatever, like maybe right before COVID, and it was terrible. It was such a bad show. I played on Sunset Beach in like a beer garden, and they thought I was a DJ. Like, they didn't have the right equipment. They didn't even promote it. It was really bad. Hopefully they've like gotten a little better over the years, but yeah. Pride, I mean, it's tricky. I don't want to go on like a huge rant about it, but they mostly just support DJs and drag artists. Like, that's what makes money. And so, yeah, for the last handful of years, I've organized, like, I did something at Green Auto where I organized this big, like, non-corporate pride show. And then I also performed in a chapel downtown maybe like 3 or 4 years ago and made like this anti-corporate pride show. I think last year I performed for Shame Fest, which is like a totally punk, like underground, like anti-corporate pride thing. And so, yeah, I don't want to hate on like corporate pride. There's a place for everything. And I believe that pride is really important still. So like, I'm glad that it exists. I don't want to be too like crotchety or political over it. But yeah, this Friday's show, yeah, that's all I have really organized for pride this year. I hope that some people come. Music, indie music is a tough sell, period. So like I'm at war with, like, you know, competing in a straight market, competing in a gay market, but they only care about drag and not music. And so it's like, it's hard to even get queers out to shows. And so we'll see how this Friday goes. Yeah. Hoping for the best, but yeah.
Of course. And I always just encourage listeners to check out their smaller, like more municipal pride events. This past week, the station was out tabling at Burnaby Pride, which is a smaller municipal pride event that is organized by like a handful of nonprofits in that city. And there's several more that I could list out, but I really recommend looking into what your municipality has, just because in the last decade or so, smaller pride events have been really cropping up and doing some great work and showing a variety of talent. I always commend Burnaby Pride for having like a huge variety of types of like queer music and art. And there is drag, but on top of that, you know, there's folk, there's rock, there's DJs, like, you know, like, understanding that, queer music, it's underrated. And it's queer music is not just like the monolith of like DJs, and DJs are great. And I enjoy a good DJ set, but allowing more space for different kinds of queer art just is beneficial to everybody.
Yeah, for sure. I performed for New West Pride a few years now, and so New West represent, like, I'm really proud of the suburbs, like, they're doing great things.
Lovely stuff. Well, I guess we're just gonna wrap up a little bit. We're gonna play some tunes. We're gonna end off this with a song called Purgatory for Vancouver Buzz Dance by Golden Age of Wrestling. Thank you so much.
tuning in to our super summer programming.
Catch us next Friday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m.
And until then, stay super chill.
Hi, I'm Amy.